say something rotten. Rotten. It'll clear the air. It's Monday. And oh, believe me, there is a lot of air to be cleared. A lot of air to be cleared. It's like, speaking of clearing the air, I, since it is Monday and I'm perfectly aware that there's nobody listening, and if they are listening, there's a little buzz in the ear, which prevents them from hearing. And to be prevented from hearing is often the most wonderful kind of balm you can have anyway in this world today. So it's Monday, you know. You figure, well, I'll get my skates sharpened yet. And one day I'll do something about my weak ankles. I know a guy who's got weak ankles that go all the way up to his ears. I didn't do something about that yet one day. You know, it's like a noodle. It's like Ollie. I remember one time Ollie, Cook with Fran and Ollie. See, he's looking out of the screen and he's kind of despondent. Kukla says, "What's the matter, Ollie? You look kind of down." And Ollie says, "I am." Kukla says, "What's the matter?" Ollie says, "Well, I keep getting these letters." And Kukla says, "What letters?" And Ollie says, "Well, letters." Kukla says, "Well, what's the matter? What do you mean, what letters? Letters, what do you mean? What's the trouble with the letters?" "Well, I keep getting these letters from people who write to me, say, you're a dragon. How come you don't squirt flames? How come you don't, smoke doesn't come out of your nostrils? What kind of a dragon are you?" And Kukla says, "You know, I've been meaning to ask you about that myself. I just didn't want to bring it up, but since it's come up now, I might as well ask you, what's the matter? What is it? I've been wondering about that." And Ollie looks out of the screen for a full 30 seconds, and finally he says, "Well, I don't like to talk about it." And Ollie sort of looks away, and Kukla says, "Well, what do you mean? What do you mean? You don't want to talk about it. What's the matter?" And Ollie says, "My fire's out." And Kukla doesn't say anything at that. He just sort of looks off screen. And Ollie says, "Do you know how it feels to be a dragon with the fire out? Everybody wants you to shoot flame, make with the smoke. My fire's out." Kukla looks out and says, "What do you think about singing a song now, huh? Let's get the subject off of the subject. How's your fire tonight? Flame burn high there? Passion running like deep, hot rivers of molten lava through your veins? Smoke coming out of the ears? The smoke of ecstasy? It's Monday. It's going to be all right. It's Monday night. Nobody's listening. Might as well talk about the truth here. Truth is everywhere. It's like over the weekend, I'm looking at the want ads. I always look at the want ads because they're little bellwethers, you know, the little tinkling bells in the long pasture of man's grazing ground. And, you know, you come across the truth. And I'm going across the one ads here in the Long Island paper. And there's an ad that says, "Pleasant woman to work for redemptionist." You know what a redemptionist is? Pleasant woman to work for a redemptionist. That's kind of proud of. You ought to sing that up. Pleasant woman to work. I can just hear... The lyrics, you know, it's in the Richard Rogers music behind it. "Pleasant woman to work for redemptionist. Good salary. Apply in person. New York Yellow Trading Stamp Company." So I guess not only do your dreams come true when you save trading stamps, but also salvation is possible through them. At least that's what redemption used to mean when I was a kid. Like there's a redemption center. I wonder if you can go down to a redemption center and get redeemed. You know, save enough green stamps. Yeah, save enough plaid stamps. "Oh, Lord, oh, brother, I hear the heavenly bugles are coming down. You got enough green stamps now to be saved forever, forever and forever. This is a redemption center, brother. You come to the right one, save plaid stamps, and your dreams will come true forever. Hallelujah." Just thought, you know, I'm sorry, it's Monday, nobody's listening anyway, so I might as well lay it out. I'm surprised, you know, the people, I wonder how many 18 billion books it must take to get a trip to Europe on those plaid stamps. Talk about building the pyramid single-handed. Takes a lot of pork and beans, a lot of celery, a lot of broadcast corned beef hash before you get that trip to Amsterdam, Daddy. And before you get fully redeemed, of course, that is. Yeah, and I'm not in focus, so I'm trying to get everything there straightened out. I'm trying to get the lenses all put together again. And I come across this ad from Abraham and Strauss. Yeah, I get the same feeling, Ted, like mad. There is a madness there that is... There is a madness that is rampant, Ted. I know, I didn't want to mention it to you. I told you guys to do something about it. You got to put the special filters in the air conditioning. I know. It's terrible. I came in, I didn't want to say anything. I thought it was the newsroom again, but it isn't. No, I know that. It's an awful thing. It comes from those bell bars. That does it. No, really, it does it, you know. It does it. That's what they call... Ted, tell them that's what they call Botticelli's second gas law. It's a Botticelli's second law. It has to do with squeezing stuff. But I'm sorry. It's the second law of Botticelli. All right, tell them to keep out of here. Let them worry about the editorial problems in the next room. While on the subject of editorials, I'm reading in the same paper, you know, it's Monday and I'm going through. Yeah, I know. Ask him what Botticelli's second law of gas formation is. It's a very interesting one. It's a terrible problem. Well, while we're on the subject of that, it's lighter than aircraft, you know. Abraham and Strauss had this ad, see, and I just finished reading about the Redemption Center, and I figure, well, I have to make a comeback here and read something serious, you know, about reality in our world. And Abraham and Strauss has what they call gleaming acetate fiber wigs for children. They refer to them as gleaming acetate fiber wigs for kiddies. And it says they're bouffant-style wigs for little girls in, quote, five fun colors. Ice blue, pink, platinum, blonde, and black. That's getting the little chick started off right. I can see this crowd of six-year-old kids in their ice blue wigs. Oi. And bouffant, yeah. We're started. And all the while, I keep hearing the sound of that plaid stamp redemptionist. I mean, you know, it's interesting that they say that you can get anything through those plaid stamp books, anything from trips to Europe. If you look all the way in the back, they have this thing for 47,000 plaid stamps. Salvation. And no one has yet claimed it, however. Ice blue is one of the fun colors. It's all part of it. Now, then again, I'm going through... I'm a great fan of Sunday papers. I figure that everything is going to come out right. If you read the Sunday paper very carefully, you'll come across most of the truth before it's over. Have you been following the career of George the Sea Lion, any of you? Have you been following that career? Well, I'd like to... I think a little cheap guitar music for this one, Eddie, since it's Monday night. And there was a headline in the Sunday paper that says, "Woman is shot after using phone for over an hour." Have you noticed that almost invariably, whenever there's a case, Ed, that involves somebody on a party line not giving up the party line when the house is burning down and the child is dying of pneumonia, and somebody gets on and screams and says, "I got to get the doctor," it's almost always... I've never heard of it being a man. I say almost always a woman. But I must be honest and say that I've never heard of a man being caught in a case like this. Every man just hangs up, says, "Okay, take the phone." Sure, there are slobs. But I've never heard of it being a man who was involved in one of these giant cases. Well, did you read that finally happened in Miami? A woman dropped a dime into a phone booth at a service station and began to talk. She talked for over 2 hours, police said. After explaining that he received business calls on his telephone, the attendant, Robert Demps, finally became exasperated. Became irritated to the point where he finally broke the connection. The woman, Inez Davis, 41, then reached for the directory to look up another number. With that, police said, Demps pulled a gun and shot her. A little cheap guitar music, yeah. Yes. Why doesn't somebody, before we go off the air tonight, look up Redemption? See whether or not plaid stamps fit. I just feel in that kind of a mood tonight. Just got to put up with it. It's the knees that go first. George, the wandering sea lion, was brought back in captivity today, caught through his own playful nature. Oh, unhappy day. Unhappy day. How many of us are caught by our own playful nature and brought back to peer through the bars of captivity? For canned salmon, his love for canned salmon brought him. George, a fugitive from a Huntington, West Virginia amusement park, was en route down the Ohio River yesterday when he spotted the Cincinnati-based towboat Claire E. Beatty. I saw him coming from the bank, said pilot Fred Walker. I could just see his head. Then he flapped in the water. I thought it was a turtle, but he was really flying. Let me tell you, he can easily outswim this boat. That thing really goes. George, the sea lion, playfully jumped aboard the towboat, and that led to his downfall. The crew enticed him to a cabin with a can of salmon and shut the door. While there, he consumed 3 cans of salmon and 4 quarts of milk. After the vessel reported the capture late yesterday near Rising Sun, Indiana. Let me tell you about Rising Sun, Indiana, some night. Any of you interested in Rising Sun? I've been in Rising Sun on many a Saturday night. And let me tell you, on Saturday night, there's nothing but setting suns as far as Main Street stretches. Oh, yeah. They're within stone's throw of the Seagram. You can smell the vats from there. Some of the natives just walk around Rising Sun and breathe deep after prayer meeting on Friday nights. Get a good solid buzz on and just sleep it off. Rising Sun, Indiana. And there is where George the Sea Lion was captured. George went off to the Cincinnati Zoo in the back of a station wagon, an ignominious trip for the animal that had playfully cavorted along 200 miles of the river since Friday. He got away and made it. Do you understand that? Yes, the sea lion made himself known to private boat operators and fishermen all along the river. He worked his way through a half dozen locks and dams. Do you know how hard that is? By the way, this is what you probably would call a seal. In New York, they're called seals. They're sea lions, you know, the smooth things that go orp, orp. You know, you've seen them. They blow bugles, Columbia Gem of the Ocean, you know that crew, with the ball on the nose and all that. He had mooched a handout of hamburger Sunday afternoon from a crew of a pleasure boat near Lawrenceburg, Indiana. George left camp. I like a sea lion that mooches sandwiches from boats. Really, he sounds great, doesn't he? George left Camden Park at Huntington last Friday by clearing a 4-foot barrier and following a creek into the Ohio. At the Cincinnati Zoo, officials said George would go into isolation just because he's a bad actor. He sounds like a great actor to me. But if the amusement park doesn't want him back, the zoo will be glad to keep him. They have only one sea lion and one in another. However, Camden Park sent a truck from Huntington to Cincinnati today to bring George back to his pond and to his mate, Jenny. Oh, George. George, how like all of us. Freedom is possible. Do you realize that? And that's what that story says. But every one of us along the line somewhere is going to sell out our freedom for a mess of pottage and a can of salmon. Speaking of mess of pottage, this is WORAM and FM New York. All right, you pot. By the way, where can you get a good mess of pottage here in this town? I'm serious, you know. I'm from a place where they really eat. And in fact, I can remember one of the first recollections I have of the Bruner family is the fact that the Bruner family never ate, they ate. That's the truth. And I remember Bruner used to come back out after supper and he'd say, well, let's get back to ball game. Sure glad I finally finished. I finally finished and I'm ready to go. Yep, sometimes it gets so that a guy can't eat without being bugged. They eat out there, and so, you know, man, is there any of you know where I can get a good mess of pottage here in town? I've tried the Four Seasons, the 12 of the Four Seen Caesars. I've tried them all. Yeah, I tried the other night. I'm with Ed Fitzgerald. I said, Ed, I'd like a mess of pottage and some curds and whey. Ed just looked at me. We wound up with asparagus and wine. You know, Ed lives pretty high off the hog. As a matter of fact, he lives about 4 feet above the hog. You mess around with living high off the hog. Speaking of hogs, we got with us here the Mandarin House. And if you like to make a veritable pig of yourself, I would suggest that you do it down at the Mandarin House. Excuse me. All right. Give me one little second away from the commercial here, Ted. This has nothing to do with the commercial. I remember speaking of making a pig of yourself. My mother... is there anyone out there whose ears used to get so dirty you could grow potatoes in them? My mother used to say, you can grow potatoes in them ears. And then once in a while she said, look at you. One day you're going to finish eating and you're just going to sit there and snort. You're going to grunt. You're making a pig of yourself. You don't eat your food, you wallow in it. That's an Indiana expression. All right, back to the commercial. If you want to wallow in your food, make a pig of yourself, I would suggest you try the Mandarin House, undoubtedly one of the greatest Oriental restaurants I've ever been in. And I want to recommend one thing. If you buy nothing else at the Mandarin House, go in the next time and ask them for five-flavor beef. Oh, it's fantastic. Oh, I wish I had a half pound of it now. Anyone call the Mandarin House? I think they're still open. Tell Emily Kuo that I'm sinking fast. Call her now. Call the Mandarin House. Say, Shepherd is sinking fast. He needs an injection of... five-flavored beef. Oh, cold, yeah. And maybe just a little finger of a martini, that's all. Call her quick. Emily Kuo, Mandarin House on 13th Street between 6th and 7th here in New York. That's the Mandarin House. Oh, man. Tonight's salute for the American of the Week goes to a 27-year-old Rhode Island man who is in county jail today, awaiting a June 8th hearing on a charge arising from an incident Sunday night in Bordentown City, Pennsylvania. Sergeant James M. Girton and Patrolman Edward Marshall stated that James Allen Peterson of Providence walked into the Masonic Temple shortly after 11 Sunday night and fell asleep in the ladies' restroom. He was charged with failing to give a good account of himself. Oh, James Allen Peterson, you are among millions. How many of us here tonight can make a good account of ourselves? How many of us tonight have not mentally fallen asleep in the ladies' room of life? And so our American of the Week award goes to James Allen Peterson of Providence. Good luck, and may your sentence be a short one. Hold that in the bay and said, I'm feeling just about right for that redemption. I feel it coming on. You just can't help but realize what a nutty, idiotic world we live in. Here's this guy falling asleep in the ladies' john. You know, and it's all beginning to pile up, and they're looking for a pleasant lady to deal with the redemptionist out there in Long Island. And here's this little note, see? It comes from the Long Island Press. And listen to this. Is this a nutty story? Listen, now listen to this, Walt. Now, just listen to this story now. Both of you in there. Just listen to this. A widow who claims her home burned down while two fire departments stood in front of the burning house and argued over which one had jurisdiction has won the right to sue one of the fire departments. Listen to that. Listen what happened. Her attorney, Mrs. Matlock, said the new Hyde Park firemen arrived first and were hooking up their hoses when the Garden City Park firemen arrived and insisted that it was their fire. The two groups consulted maps and debated for over an hour and a half while the fire raged on, she claims. Did you hear that story, Ed? I guess not. It's too bad because it says so much about our world. I'm telling you, I don't know whether to make a comment or just leave that one lay. I think we'll just leave that one lay. There's nothing to say about it. Did you hear that, Ed? The two fire departments are arguing it out while a lady's house burnt down. One guy got his hose hooked up, and the other one arrived with a map and says, "This is our fire." Just thought you ought to know that it's all going on out there. I mean, what would you say? You're standing out, "Come on, fellas." And the roof falls in and the house blows up. And finally says, "Well, it's too late now. It's a total loss. Let's go." You messed around. And then there was this great note in the New York Times. It's all here. It says, "Feather hoard reduced by U.S. Joint Committee reports on condition of feather stockpiles." Did you hear about that? We're up to our hocks in feathers. The government's goose feather glut has been lightened by 375,000 pounds. A committee of Congress reported today the strategic stockpile of feathers now stands at 10,220,000 pounds of goose feathers. Yes, sirree, folks, it's time all up and down the river. It's time for the Ohio River recorded hillbilly jamboree. Stop it, cut it out. For God's sake. Madness here. I have to tell this, you know, it's terrible. I have to tell this kind of stuff on yourself. But do you know, Walt, you know, none of these guys were on here radio men, you know, here at WOR. They're WOR men. That's different. Like one night, it's a terrible thing. I'm walking through the TV, and I says, "You know, someday I'm going to get into television." And, I'm walking around up here one day, and we got talking about radio. You know, I'm surprised at the number of people here at WOR who have only worked here in New York. Radio men, they really don't know about radio, you know. All they know about is New York radio. It's very different. And I'm going to have to answer to this, I'm sure, when I get up before that great judge, some of the things I've done in the past, and I'll never forget one show I used to do. Now, you set that record up, Ed. Set it right up in the beginning there. I'll show you how to. All right, now, here's the way I used to say. I used to come on like this. "Hiya, friends and neighbors. Are you all out there? Are you all set and ready to go? Do you begin to feel it coming up from way down inside of you? Yes, sirree, friends and neighbors, it's Saturday night, and it's time for the Hillbilly Jamboree. All up and down the old Ohio River, from all the way up to Wheeling, all the way down to the big locks of Portsmouth, it's time for the Ohio River Jamboree, and this is old Cousin Chucky here. Let's go, gang.
Hold it.
Yes, sir. And then I used to say, before I would get going, and I hope you don't mind these awful reminiscences, before I get going, I'd say, "Well, folks, we got them all here. We got Arkansas Wood Choppers here just a-coming out of our ears. We got Lula Bell and Scotty and Montana Slim all ready to sing and pick and shout and holler for you. But before we do that, we'd like to give you a word or two about P. Runa. Yes, sirree, folks, P. Runa. We'll be right back in 35 or 40 seconds with the word on P. Runa. We also have another word here for you for color back. If all of you folks out there who have been suffering from gray hair, who have been suffering from premature aging of those wonderful curly locks of yours, we'd like to talk to you about that new magic, wonderful ingredient, color back. Color back will guarantee to bring back your hair. Bring it back. Oh, we go. The feather hoard is reduced by the United States. Yeah. I wish you know, I seriously do. I figured that it would do me a lot of good if I could learn to take it seriously. I wish I could get as serious about the world as John Gambling can get about Westchester school announcements. I mean, just a little thing. Just give me one little thing that I could cling to, that I can make my own. And I'd be more than glad to make it my own
you could point out one little thing that I can make my own. Now, on the other hand, see, I'm looking through the paper. I'm just leafing it through. Now, the reason I'm doing you this is because I think Monday is a good time just to review the weekend's developments. The Mets lost, and of course, you don't know anything about losing. I'm serious. You know, a lot of people talk about the Mets, and I think they're missing the point of the Mets. I think that New York is such a town of winners that it's very rare that any of us ever get a chance to see an honest-to-John loser. You know, I mean a loser that does it publicly and really does it. and so it gives you a vague sense of superiority. Have you noticed that on the sport pages there have been 25 different articles as to why the Mets are so popular? It seems to me that they're popular because they're losing. I mean that. I'm not being facetious. That we got plenty of winners in this town. Plenty of winners. Richard Rodgers, Mary Martin, Roger Maris, Mickey Mantle. We got winners coming out of our ears. And there's hardly anybody who is around who is a public loser. And yet there are millions of us who are private losers, but public winners. I mean, plaid stamps, you get your dreams, I mean, everything. You got to admit, if you're a true Life magazine reader, you're living the good life right up to the hilt. And yet there's the secret sense of defeat on all of us. And so I believe, I really do, I seriously believe that there is a great purgative quality to the steady losing of the Mets. Here in New York City, any other city, they'd be in trouble. But no, not here in New York. Because believe me, boy, more and more, this is a town of winners. And you better be a winner, Dad, or you are in serious trouble in New York. Bad trouble. And it's more in this town than it is any place else I think of, that I can offhand think of in the Western world, any place I've ever been. You know, the drive to make it is not nearly as strong in Chicago as the drive to make it is in New York. There's something in the air. Just something in the air, really. There it's almost a sickness with many people in this town. And that wild light of a man who is really... aiming at something he never can quite understand, except he calls it success. It's just success. And it's a wild thing in the city. And, of course, it's a very difficult thing when most of us are not capable of it. And success, by the way, involves other people's failure. It has to. And yet those other people are hung on success, too, you know. So by the very nature of success, there has to be some losers. And most of us are. And, oh, boy, the terrible thing that flows through this. I didn't realize it, you know, until I came to New York, just how strong that thing is, how rough it is. I had never seen a city where I can remember just 1 year ago, or maybe even 2 years ago, I'll be honest and say 2 years ago, where the idiotic fans, the Yankee fans, were yelling and screaming to sell Mickey Mantle. Now today they love him. Why? Well, he's batting .348 or something, and he's leading the league and something, and he's obviously, you know. But the thing that is interesting about that is that people say in Chicago, and I'm not saying they're better in Chicago, it's just different air. They'll continue to go out to see the White Sox win or lose, you know. Just the way they are. They think winning is a kind of an extra plus to going out to the ball game. But here, winning is a requisite to go out to the ballgame. If the Yankees don't win, you don't go see them. That's it. And if the Yankees win the pennant, and they happen to lose the World Series in 7 games, they fire the manager. Insanity personified. I mean, this is the New York world. And everyone is for it. Get rid of that old clown, you know? Wins 19 straight pennants or something, and loses the World Series in the 7th game, get rid of him. Obviously, he's no good. So there's a different atmosphere here, and so the Yankees have gotten to be a kind of a dull ball club because they win too much. You know, it's been just too many years. There's no excitement anymore in the Yankees winning, but there is excitement in the Mets losing, because the sight of a loser, an honest to John public loser, is a rare sight in New York. Even guys who get fired in New York don't get fired; they get released so that they can grow more with another concern. You know, I've seen many a guy saying, oh, no, I didn't quit. You see, they figured that the opportunities were limited, and they called me in and said, well, we're going to give you a chance to grow with some other organization. So that's the creative bounce that's positive thinking in the face of total disaster. So nobody really loses in New York, really. Not fully, except the Mets. And the Mets have done it how many straight games now? 15? But, of course, I'll tell you that New York doesn't understand losers yet. If you think the Mets are losers, you don't really know about losers. Not really. The reason I'm saying this is because, after all, the Mets are a new ball club. And you don't expect the Mets to be much anyway. They're new. But how would you like to have a ball club that's been playing ball for 50 straight years in the same city that loses 24 straight games? 24 straight games. I know. I read that. Yeah. I love these guys that come into New York for 4 minutes and don't speak the language, and they make giant pronouncements about how the city is. Titov. I mean, you know. I wonder what we would think if an American arrived in Moscow and started to make public rotten statements. Can you imagine John Glenn, for example, going to Moscow? I don't like Moscow because it's a city that doesn't allow people to swing. We're poor, silly, sappy Americans. We'd say something good like Moscow is a wonderful and exciting city and they have a great ballet. You know, that kind of jazz. So we kind of love it, the fact that the Titov comes around and says, New York, big machine which grind the people down to nothings. Big machine. Oh, come on, get off of it, Titov. You don't know about New York. You stick to flying that thing around there. I mean, you know. And I'm not chauvinistic. I'm just saying I don't think he's qualified. Sorry, Al. But while on the subject of the Mets, I'm fascinated by the phenomenon of the Mets as public losers in New York. And I suspect that if they were having a 50-50 season, nobody would be interested. If they would be, it would be a sort of a ho-hum interest, the kind that says, well, next year it'll be better. But nobody really wants the Mets to be better out there, some reason or other. And I think the reason is back to that victory, defeat thing. Of course, you always have a hope that the defeated will win. But it's the kind of hope that it's the sweet, sad hope. It's like a liberal, a real true liberal, you know, is always mad about the way things are being done, you know. And it's a sweet kind of madness, being a liberal. He loves it. It isn't the kind of madness of a Barry Goldwater who's very angry. You know, it's a sweet kind of anger. When I say sweet, I mean it's the kind of anger that is savored by the man. It's the kind of disappointment that makes you feel like you're a martyr and that you're on the side of the angels. You know what I mean by that kind of anger? It's a peculiar kind of anger, but it's the kind that comes with defeat, not victory. And so when you're a little man and you win, you feel guilt-ridden. That either it was a fluke or you shouldn't be there. You know, it's like crashing a giant party somewhere. You'd much rather be on the outside walking around in the snow saying, I wouldn't want to go anyway. Look at them in there, rotten people. Rotten. And if they open the door and say, come on in, Charlie, we got some cake for you, some champagne. What do you do then? Then you really feel terrible. You know, it's like how Mort Saul must have felt the day after the election and the Democrats were in. His whole act is shot. Just like that, you got to start rebuilding from the very beginning, very foundation. He hasn't made it back yet. Not really. I mean, he brings out Ike once in a while, but you know, talks about Kennedy and his rocking chair and a few little things like that. But the old fire isn't there. It's like Ollie's fire. It's gone out. And so I suspect that the Mets fill a very important function. I have not been as excited at a ball game in 5 years as I've been going out to the Mets, and I've gone to dozens of Yankee games. Because when the Mets score a run, that's a fantastic achievement. You know, you go out of your mind. They've scored another one. You know, they've got two runs now. I wouldn't have believed that. I see the day when they'd score two runs in one game. And you sit there. Of course, the other team has scored nine. But the fact that you score two is a tremendous achievement, you know. Then they finally have a big rally. They get another run. And then you go home feeling great. Well, we almost made it today. Hi, George. Now you're beginning to understand what I meant about the White Sox. When they used to have block parties, when Luke Appling would get two hits. Of course, we lost 4-0, but Luke got two hits. And I can remember the excitement. Oh, speaking of that, I want to tell you, do you guys read, ever? Any of you ever read the obit page in any of the big papers? Listen, I'm going to put you a little quiz. This guy was on the, it was a sad thing that I read in the paper. He's gone now. Wait, before you go, Al, I want you to listen to this. He's gone, see? Quit fooling with the records. You can do that anytime you want. This guy, I read in the paper, he's gone. And the thing I remember about him as a kid, he was one of the very few ball players. You know, people who get to a position of importance in any tough, competitive, professional field generally are devoid of humor. Very few comics, who, believe it or not, who get to the top in the comic field have any humor at all. Very unfunny people. Oh, yes, very unfunny. They say funny lines, but they are not humorous people because they have achieved a great memory for material along the way. And so they just keep whipping out these lines. That doesn't mean that they're funny. That means they got a very good memory. And you take away their material and they just sit there and glower. A ballet dancer. It takes a lot of work and fantastic dedication to become a ballet dancer. You wind up, when you talk to these people, it's like talking to a brick wall. Because they're so self-involved. Actresses, oh wow, in spades. All the way on up and down the line. So it's very rare that somebody who gets to the top in any profession that is fantastically competitive retains a sense of humor, particularly about what he does. Very few ball players are funny. Arthur Daly, to the contrary, who writes this stuff. And somebody wrote a note to me and implied that I had said the other night that Arthur Daly was the guy that I wanted to meet. I had read an article in the Times. No, it is not Arthur Daly. It is Robert Daly, who also writes for the Times, but a very different kind of writer. Very different. He'll never win any prizes, but with me, he'll win them all. You know, he'll never win any of the official prizes because he doesn't write those warm stories of colorful nothings. You know, the heart-tugging things. He writes about the guys that just about made it and then dropped out in the end of the third lap, you know. He does, and this is just a beautiful writer. Oh, drivers, everything. I'll never forget the story that Robert Daly wrote about the racer, the mile runner in Europe, who was deathly afraid that one day he was going to get beaten. And he was unbeatable. And all of a sudden, he was running in a race one day, and he suddenly got the idea that maybe he'd get beaten. And with that, 28 guys passed. I mean, he's never won a race since. Oh, boy, what a frightening story. Does that sound like home base? That sounds like all of us here. So anyway, I'm reading the obits the other night, and I come across this name, and it made me very sad, because this was the name of a ball player who was one of the very few ball players I've ever seen who had a sense of humor about himself. He was a tremendous hitter, and his batting average, he was always up in the 330s, 340s, 350s sometimes, and he was on the All-Star team one year, and the reason he got on the All-Star team was because all the fans got together in Chicago and voted him on. As a kind of practical joke, he was the world's worst fielder. And I remember one game he made about four errors out in left field. He was the kind of fielder, you know, that would run very fast. You'd see him running very fast, making a tremendous try. But if you looked at him long enough, you saw that he hadn't moved. You know, that kind of guy. He ran 13 minutes in one place, straining. And so he was wonderful to watch in this way because he had a sense of humor. And the White Sox were behind something like 10-1. And he's out in left field, see. So he has made about four straight errors. And I heard this on the radio, and I'll tell you, I almost fell under the Crosley when I heard it. Bob Elson is describing the scene. And somebody drills a line drive out in the left field, and it's bouncing along, hitting in the grain. It's cutting the grass and rolling out on the ground towards this outfielder. Well, remember, he's made four errors already in the game. So he comes trotting up to it, and he gets ready to field it, and instead, he lays down in front of it, which means that he's going to stop this one. It ain't going to go past him. He lays down there sideways across. The ball takes a bad hop right over him, rolls to the wall for a triple. He gets another error. And Elson described it. He says, look at him. He's laying down. The ball's hopped over, took a bad hop. It's rolling to the wall. I'll award you the... And he's gone now. He died at 54. Of a heart attack. And he was such a colorful ball player, such a wonderfully colorful ball player. And he played in the days when the White Sox were always down in seventh and eighth place. He played with Luke Appling up ahead of him there. Ted Lyons, a 20-game winner who never won over about eight or nine games a year because the Sox booted everything he would win. They'd boot him right into the dugout. Nine errors a game. They'd score two runs a week, the White Sox. That was a year that Appling batted .388, by the way. Really did. He batted .388, won the American League batting championship, and drove in 27 runs. There was just never anybody on base. Never anyone. One-man team. And this outfielder was a short, kind of round, wonderful, funny outfielder. And he was a great favorite on the South Side. Did you read it? Do you know who it is? You don't remember the name of the guy? Well, I'll tell you, he was a left-handed hitter. I'll give you that much. Nobody remembers. Well, all right. Do you remember the name of Rip Radcliffe? You see, that's how fame is. You don't remember him. Well, I do, and I read, there it was, standing there, Rip Radcliffe, little thing at the bottom of the New York Times page there, you know, the obit page, it said Rip Radcliffe is gone. And I remember Rip Radcliffe out there in left field. I remember one time Radcliffe did something that I'll never forget. I saw. It was the only time I've ever seen an outfielder make three errors on one play. Rip Radcliffe did this. He came in under a fly ball and dropped it. Picked the fly ball up. Now get this. Picked the fly ball up. Overthrows second base. Well, he runs around. All right, so there's two errors. Somebody picks the ball up back of the pitcher's mound, throws to second base again. It rolls out to the outfield. Rip grabs it again and throws it in the stand. He made three errors on one play, and then here's what happened. Everybody is cheering Radcliffe. Radcliffe takes off his hat and doffs it to the crowd. A great ball player. You remember Rip Radcliffe?